The good lady, they used to say you can't start the ball game till the fat lady finishes singing. Some of you New Yorkers will know what I'm talking about. I just heard the good lady's voice. To all my dear students who are precious to me, and I'm both here, and it was very moving to be able to speak to so many people on Thursday night. If I could have time, I would redo the Thursday Shir and show you. It was based upon something I said in class, but a little different, and explain to you why I spoke and what I spoke about. There was a Torah there was a Zohar, a hidden Torah behind the oral Torah, but we'll leave that perhaps for another time. Today is June 1st, 2020, and I say hello to everyone in front of me and those listening from afar. It's a very happy day for me. A few hours ago, I gained the news that I became wealthier. I have another great-grandson, Kanayin Hara. And this has implications for next Monday. I don't know what the story is with the Brit, obviously, but Morty, I'll let you know.
Mazal tov.
Thank you. It's also, I wanted to have the joy of showing everyone, this is my granddaughter's Isha Kenisa Umaba Lakota Hamarabi. Could you imagine? You had to have a lottery and you had to win to be able to go to the Kotel. What's fascinating about this is all the signatures on it. Mishteret Yisrael, Medina Yisrael, Keren HaKotel HaMaravi. Wow. But Baruch Hashem, she went, she enjoyed. However, it's a very, very sad day. Right after Rabbi Lam died, his son-in-law, my dear Talmud, Rabbi Mark Dratch, called. And I want to say more than a few words about Rabbi Lam. We have someone listening who has the exact same name, Nachum Lam, as Rabbi Norman Lam was also Nachum Lam. And I'll remind my Talmud Nachum Lam that whenever you wanted to see Rabbi Lam, as busy as he was, he told his girl Friday, who I also knew, and she really protected him and took care of him. And Rabbi Lam said to his girl Friday, whenever Nachum Lam wants to see me, let him in. How can I say no to someone who has exactly my name? And by the way, the two Nachum Lams may be related. They came from the same area in Europe, and many of the family names are the same, so they may very well be distant cousins. Rabbi Lam represents an entire era. I would say there's no one who can better portray what happened after 1950 in the development of Torah within the greater Yeshiva University world than Rabbi Dr. Norman Lam. He was born in 1927, and he basically was a Torah Vadas youngster. He was a Brooklyn boy. His grandfather, Rabbi Yoshua Baumel from the famous Baumel family, these were tremendous Talmidei Chachamim. He was a rabbi in Brooklyn. He authored a sefer which Rabbi Norman Lam gave me. Eimek Halacha was his grandfather's sefer, Shelef and Shuvah. And if you recall my lectures, when we spoke about the Malachim, it was his grandfather that wrote the Shuvah that permitted Mr. Mendelevich to kick the Malachim out of Masifta Teira Vadas. It's today, no one would believe what I'm saying, but Baruch Hashem, as you recall, I actually showed you the Sefer. It's printed and published, and it's there for anyone to see. And then after high school, Normie, pardon me for calling him Normie, but I was sort of a Talmud Chaver of his, I would say. Normie switched to Yeshiva College. And again, that's indicative of what the world was like then. The chasm between Teira Vadas and Yeshiva College was not as great as it is today. Today, it's practically laughable because the Rosh Yeshiva of Teira Vadas is a Yeshiva University product, Rabbi Yitzchak Lichtenstein. But it's E. Lichtenstein. But in those days, there was I would say, a social and even a physical relationship. It was a two-way bridge, more one way to Yeshiva College. And Rabbi Lamb, by the way, had a very erudite, capable brother. I believe the brother was younger, Maurice, who predeceased him. Maurice Lamb and Normie both came from Teira Vadas to Yeshiva College. And Rabbi Lamb went on to, of course, get his bachelor's, get his smicha, ultimately his doctorate. He's a total Yeshiva College product. What many of you don't know, and it's what's fascinating, is that after college, he attended the Polytech Institute of Brooklyn. He was more interested in chemistry than in going into the rabbinate. It was a time of, after the Holocaust, the founding of the State of Israel. And he actually, and this historically lends itself to some interesting research, Henry Morgenthau Jr., this is an assimilated German Jew, later became Secretary of Treasury, very successful. The fact that he's called Junior, imagine the same name as his father, Senior, Junior, it tells you how assimilated these German Jews were. And this is the Jew that Rabbi Kalmanovich fainted in front of him, pleading for him to act for the Jews in the area controlled by Hitler. Yimach Shmo v'Zichro. Henry Morgenthau broke down, cried with Rabbi Kalmanovich, and he became a Jew again. And he did, you can check it out, World War II, he was responsible for formation committees, yelled, shouted, Roosevelt. He personally, his actions saved hundreds, if not a few thousand Jews. I don't want to overestimate it, how many could have been saved if we had more Henry Morgenthau Jr.'s. His son, Robert Morris Morgenthau, already a different name, Robert Morris. He was involved in, also a chemist, had some sort of business, and he was involved in illegal activities in creating armament bombs, whatever. And again, it has to be all researched properly for the State of Israel, for Palestine, for the Jews, for the fighting. There was an embargo, it was all illegal. Normie Lamb worked with him. There was a whole little group. This morning I spoke with my neighbor at the Minyan, the Gabbai, not the Gabbai Corona we now have. At every Minyan there's a Gabbai, and there's a Gabbai Corona in charge that all the regulations are listened to. So I spoke with Sam Dershowitz. And Sam, who you went on to get a PhD in chemistry, his whole life he's been a chemist, although I often feel that Sam is a frustrated rabbi. He's a tremendous darshan, Talmud Chacham, but he was a chemist. That was his profession, PhD from Columbia U. And he told me he was desperate to work for Morgenthau, and he couldn't. He was 16. You had to be 18 or over. Norman Lamb was a few years older. He was able to, and Sam was not. Now, you should know, in memory of Henry Morgenthau, there is a moshav in Israel, Tal Shachar, in the middle of the country, an old moshav. Many Olim lived there, farmers. It has an entire history. Tal Shachar is Morgenthau in German, Morgenthau, Tal Shachar. It's named after Henry Morgenthau. All right, Rabbi Lamb's father, also interesting. His mother was the daughter of this great Rav. His father, I still remember his father. Any of you remember him? A short man, a gentleman, a Europeish gentleman. And he worked for the state in Kashrut. There was a New York state law, I think it was overthrown in modern times with the conservative and our enemies from within. Forget about our enemies from without. but the state supervised kashrus in the sense that you couldn't be false. That if you said you were kosher, you had to show you had hashgacha, and that it was proper. And he was the inspector for the state, as I recall. I remember meeting him a number of times. What children he raised. He and his wife had four children, two boys, two girls. And of course, Norman went into the rabbinate. He was in Springfield, Massachusetts. Interestingly enough, Rabbi Lazer Silver was also in Springfield. Rabbi Silver became famous in Springfield, Rabbi Lam as well. He, tradition, and again, you know, you take for granted today, we have tradition, we have Chakira. I believe there's another magazine as well that's a little bit more right-wing than either one. Today, we take for granted, we have all these magazines, all these periodicals, all these scholarly journals in English and Orthodox, Taridic. It was a great achievement. And Rabbi Lam's reputation, David Posen, went up and up and up. And he had to be brought back to New York. He became the assistant rabbi of Jewish Center, assisting Rabbi Young, who we spoke about. And he, 1 year later, was 58, the assistant, 59, he became the rabbi of the Jewish Center. And he went on, he had his doctorate, they're also interesting, his scholarship, a multifaceted individual. His doctorate, if you recall, was Torah Lishma. It was on Lithuanian Derech of Limud and Rav Chaim Volozhin, what Rav Chaim was all about. His doctorate, and this the family boasts about until today, he's the only person to both get smicha from the Rav, and his doctorate was under the Rav's guidance and tutelage for Bernard Rebel Graduate School. In other words, I have a smicha from the Rav, but my doctorate is Bernard Rebel Graduate School under the guidance. Chairman of the committee was Professor Hyman Bogomilsky Grinstein, Zichrona Levracha, nicest guy alive, but not the Rav. And Normie Lam, who worked on Rav Chaim Volozhin, the faculty turned to the Rav to be the chairman, to guide it, to be the mentor. Later in life, he writes some classic work on the Hasidic world. So here you have an individual who both Litvisha world and the Hasidisha world, and he understood both. And his volumes are basic in these two fields. Beyond the pure scholarship, there was no one who defined what we now call, and Rabbi Lam gave it the name, centrist orthodoxy. He was upset with the word modern orthodoxy. I think I've said many times, I don't like the word modern orthodoxy because it implies that we have to modernize our Torah. We have to modernize ourselves to live in accordance with Torah, but it's not the Torah that needs to be made modern. The word centrist orthodoxy, which he coined in a famous talk he gave in Fifth Avenue Synagogue, I remember it was in the 80s, there he came up with a term that is much more acceptable. I prefer to go beyond it and say a Torah Jew in the modern world, or a Torah Jew better in the Western world. But centrist orthodoxy is a good catch because it's two words. Raketet is being mefalpel, Torah Jew in the Western world. Too many words, it doesn't catch on. Centrist orthodoxy. It caused a tremendous counter-reaction, and some of you remember the Aguda Convention, where Rabbi Chaim Dov Keller spoke out against Rabbi Lam, Rabbi Yitzvei spoke out against Rabbi Lam, and there too, life is fascinating. Chaim Dov Keller came from the same background as Normie Lam. They were roommates in dormitory in Yeshiva College. They were classmates and roommates in the dorm. And it was Rabbi Chaim Dov Keller's third year, junior year. And that was the year of the dean's reception. The tradition in my time was the junior year, you had the dean's reception. Dean's reception, you came with your date. And that machloket, I have no idea what goes on today, but the machloket broke out in the 40s, continued in my time, as the Torah world moved more right-wing, Mapidon, girls coming into the yeshiva, juniors in college on dates, the Rav's attitude, that I heard this with my own ears in the hallway when he was arguing with the Chafetz Chaim, son-in-law of Mendel Zaks, Besser says, don't treff him in the yeshiva, nicht auf dem Gas. Better they should meet in the yeshiva and not on the streets. And Rav Chaim Dov Keller led the battle against the dean's reception and lost, and he left the yeshiva. In other words, he gave up 3 years of college. I remember in my time in Lakewood, there was one YU guy, I remember him so well, an Adela, and he was a junior in college, and he came to Lakewood, and he went over to Rabarin, and he asked Rabarin Mori, this you have to tell your wife, it's your family now, and he asked Rabarin, I am breaking into Yiddish, forgive me, I'm living it. He asked Rabarin, what should I do? I have 1 year of yeshiva college left, but I want to learn, I don't want to go to college. And Rabarin told him, mit ein Jahr kem rata v'ndraya. With 1 more year, you can save the 3 years. In other words, if you're ready, put 3 years into college, get the degree. That's what Rabarin Kutla Paskin for him. And he listened to Rabarin. And I remember Rabbi Keller left Yeshiva College, and you can understand already, as the years moved on, here are twins who grew up together, the same background, the same yeshivas, the same dormitory, classmates, roommates, and one went Agudat Yisrael, Moetzet Gedolia Torah, Rav Chaim Dov Keller, and Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb, the third president, Rosh Yeshiva, Yeshiva Shulchanin, Yeshiva University. It was a real break. I have to say that Rabbi Yitzvei and his attack on Rabbi Lamb, those of you with the tapes are still around from the 1980s, you'll see that I was very upset and it was really not right. Meaning, Rabbi Lamb gave a whole talk about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai coming out of the cave. Maybe some of you remember this. And when you have to come out of the cave, you have to face the real world. You can't start looking at everyone and killing everyone and being critical of everyone. And I know this feeling. Sometimes I walk along on Shabbos and I see cars and my feeling then is they know you have to, you can't maledict, you have to be calm, etc. But when you come out of the cave, Kolzman, and they criticized Rabbi Lamb that he said the yeshivas are a cave. All I can tell you is I heard a shmuis from my mashkiach, from my masnich, Rabbi Yaakov Moshe Kohen Lessin, and had zugestellt as men lernt an yeshiva, das is an atevas noach, that when you're learning in yeshiva, it's like Noach in the ark. And in the ark, you're in your own world, then you have to leave the ark. You have to know how to adjust to the challenges of the world when you face the vineyards. And what are you going to do first? The Noah, you all know what I'm referring to. And it was exactly the same concept based upon different sources that Rabbi Lamb had mentioned. And to criticize him for that, what are you talking about? That's the zeal creed. It's basic to Torah existence. Of course, that's what a yeshiva is about. That's what Musar is about. And when you went to a Chassidic court and you visited the Rebbe, it's those precious moments when you're away from the maelstrom of the world. But then you have to go back and you have to live within the reality of where we are, where we function, where we are alive. So I want to defend Rabbi Lamb even today, so many years later, repeat what I said. I want to mention one volume which is lost because everyone is talking about his major volumes on Torah Mada, his volumes on Hasidus, his volume on Torah Lishma, both there's the Hebrew version, the English version, but there's one volume he wrote, which I consider his finest work, a little volume published by Feldheim, 77, Hedge of Roses on Taret Mishpacha. I think it's the finest work. It's not the halacha. It's not a halachic volume. There are many little volumes on Taret Mishpacha, but this is on the ethics, the morals, the psychology, the philosophy, the life reality, what Taret Mishpacha is about. And I consider that his finest, finest work. I actually arranged to have it translated into Russian. And I don't think there was any other volume that Shvut Ami published that aroused so much interest and so much demand. It went through quite a few printings because the demand was so great. So you have Hedge of Roses. I know of an English edition. I know of a Russian edition. There may be others, but this just gives you a little bit insight who the man was. Now, I want to add a thought. I may be right, I may be wrong. It's one of the guesses when you try to guess the past and try to understand people. And it's worth thinking about what I'm going to answer. I had a very simple question. Rabbi Lam was the third president of Yeshiva. The first two presidents, great European Talmidei Chachamim, both struggled with such ill health at such a young age. Rabbi Revel barely made it to his mid-50s. Rabbi Belkin barely made it to his mid-60s. And Rabbi Lam was Zeichel Arichat Yomim Tovim, could retire in dignity. And here I think when you look at the ages that they took over the presidency, Rabbi Revel was about born in 1885, I should say, 1940. 1940 he died, excuse me, 1915. He was 30 years of age. Rabbi Belkin, born 1911, became president 1943. Well, make the cheshbon, he was barely 31, 32. They were too young. It was overwhelming. They had no life experience. Rabbi Lam had the advantage of many years in the rabbinate. And Springfield, Massachusetts, Jewish Center, Balabatim, challenges. Life is all not a bed of roses. Hachayim einim tutim, if I can paraphrase the Israeli expression. He had his challenges, his successes, his frustrations, his ups, his downs. He was ready. He was ripe. He could handle the presidency. When he took over, Yeshiva was ounces away from bankruptcy, if you remember the story. And he took over the Yeshiva at that moment in time and turned it into a solvent institution. I also want to mention part of great leadership is to know how to pick out quality people to help you. And here, you look at Rabbi Lam. I want to mention one name, someone that really we haven't given the proper credit to. And that was my classmate, Sheldon Sokol, Zichrona Levracha. Financially, Sheldon took that burden off Rabbi Lam's shoulders. Rabbi Revel had to carry it alone. Rabbi Belkin had to carry it alone. Rabbi Lam had Sheldon Sokol. And you know, everyone was angry at Sheldon. He doesn't permit this, he doesn't permit that. Besof Sheldavah, we see what happens in the decades after Rabbi Lam's presidency, you got to give Sheldon Sokol all the credit. He was the Sar HaOtzer, and he guided and loved the yeshiva. And part of Rabbi Lam's success, you have to credit to Sheldon Sokol. I can tell you one story about Sheldon. I've told it years ago. Let me repeat it again. People should know. I hope someone one day will write in Rabbi Lam and will understand this. Yeshiva, Rabbi Lam was a tremendous mensch, Gomel Chassidat, such a good human being. And there was someone he gave a job to in the yeshiva that perhaps he shouldn't have. Dov, you're going to understand me better than anyone because you know what I'm referring to. And under this person's tutelage, he was a mashkiach, no longer alive, I don't want to mention his name, but Rabbi Lam knew him from Yeshiva College. They might have even been chavrutas in the 40s. There was a bit of a problem in one part of the kashrut. They found something not right. Well, an emergency meeting was called, and the question was, La'an, what do you do? How do you supervise so many different kitchens, Uptown, Stern, Einstein, Cardoza? And this meeting was called with people from the OU and Mashkichim and Kashrut. You have to pay money. You can't just have Kashrut without hiring people to do the job. So you should know there was a lot of talk going back and forth, how much it would cost. And Sheldon Sokol got up and said, gentlemen, Yeshiva University cannot afford one inch of scandal. Its kashrut has to be 100%. We are going with the OU, and I don't care how much it costs. And Manny Holzer, who was the czar of kashrut, he was the head of the rabbinic RCA commission that worked with the OU, and he was the czar of kashrut. He really learned, he had time. He learned it from Aleph to Tuf. Manny said it was one of the most expensive hashgachas the OU had to give because it involved so many different places, so many different mashkichim. But Sheldon Sokol, it was six figures plus, Sheldon Sokol said, it has to be. So you see, this was Sheldon Sokol. This was Rabbi Lam. This was how the yeshiva functioned and how Rabbi Lam was able to turn it entirely around. Now, let me say another word and pay tribute. When you're in the public limelight, not easy to raise children. I need not tell you, we have many examples of great Rabbanim and what became of their children. God have mercy. Some of you know I've taught you a Yiddish phrase, Arabzatochta. You have women, their hatred, their enmity for Judaism cannot be matched. It's to the second power. I'll give you examples, not important. There's an expression, with that hatred, you know she grew up in a rabbinic home. All right, there are reasons why. We don't go into it now psychologically. And today rabbis are trained how to deal with family, wives, human situations, etc. The Lambs raised four wonderful children. The eldest Chaya, I know the least, but I know of her, Chaya Warburg, terrific people. The one I knew the best was her sister, Sarah. The year that Rabbi and Mrs. Lam, or maybe a year, 2 years, they were in Israel, Sarah was a classmate of my daughter in Chorev. She later married a very dear Talmud of mine, Mark Dratch. And here I want to pay tribute to that couple. They were one of a kind, Talmidei Chachamim, wonderful parents, very devoted children. The Ribbono Shel Olam has his cheshbonot, And both Maurice and Norman, unfortunately, buried daughters, b'chayehem. Maurice buried his daughter, a dear student of mine. And then Norman Lamb buried Sarah. And Mark was not just a son-in-law. Mark was a son-in-law slash son, underlined the word son. And something that Mark did, I'm holding in front of me, I hope you can see it. 7 Ibn Shtiya, or Ibn Shtiya, al Pirkei Avot. Ha'arot v'ha'arot mipri et yov shel Rav Nachum ben Meir Shmuel Lamb. Mark, there's on the cover is Rabbi Lamb, and of course, if we're talking about Rabbi Lamb, Eshet Chavah Kechavah, that's Mindy, who probably, I'm sure Norman will forgive me for saying, she probably deserves 2/3 of the credit in raising the children. A wonderful, wonderful person who just died a few weeks ago from Corona. And in this Sefer, which is in English, although the title is in Hebrew, Mark puts together all his father-in-law's comments from sermons and teachings on Pirkei Avot. And if you want to really understand what Torah Mother is about, I refer you to page 127 and further, where he quotes Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, Yafet Tam Torah Derech Eretz. And he raises the whole issue, what is Derech Eretz about? Is it a compromise? In other words, if we have no choice, we have to go to college, as Rav Aaron told my chavid, dear, as I recall his name, Rav Aaron told him, "Etein yakim and ratav in draya." All right, you wasted your time, finish out one more year and forget about any secular teachings. Or no, is knowledge, wisdom, secular wisdom, it's part of God's creation. It's not to make a living, it's not a b'diyevit, it's not because we have no choice, it's because the challenge of man to live intelligently and with dignity in the great world around him. And this is Rav Hirsch. People try to deny it. There's the famous tutor of Baruch Belevevich. I don't get into details now. I quoted in my work in Rebel. I've lectured on it extensively over the generations. But the truth is, look at Hermann Schwab's history, published in 1948 in London. This is an uncle to the famous Rabbi Schwab of New York. And look at his work on Rav Hirsch. This is the heart of Rav Hirsch, the value of knowledge, knowledge per se, all part of God's creation. And here it's developed a number of different places, but where I cite it is the heart where Rabbi Lamb takes on. And this is his interpretation of centrist orthodoxy. Let me conclude. On my own personal level, the two girls, the two sons, Shalom and Josh, I know them all. I have the privilege of telling you that both boys married very wonderful students of mine from Mechlala. And over the years, both Shalom and Josh became my students, not only by osmosis through their wives, but by listening to the Sheyurim on YU Torah or whenever I gave public lectures in West Hempstead, where they all live. Mark, who's gone through a lot in life, to lose a wife, not simple for Rabbi Lamb and Mrs. Lamb, Mindy, to lose a daughter, not simple. But this is the human being, and this is one of the tragedies of those who want to reform everything, and we'll be talking about it in the class today, next week. life is not perfect. It's not yet the Messianic era. A great-grandson was born to me today. I'm a very wealthy man. I can't even, don't want to even tell you where I'm at with great-grandchildren, because I know there's a minute they tell me if you have over 20, you don't mention the number. So I cannot mention the number, believe me. But you do a brit milah. And why? Why didn't God complete the man? Why does he leave us for a brit milah, for Seinfeld? Remember, there's the episode in Seinfeld where they laugh at it. It was just someone sent me a link, as my dear student Steve Gross, to an episode with Mayim Bialik stars in it. And what they do with the brit milah, and Hashem Yirachem, what comes out of it with the baptism. It's frightening. Why didn't God complete it? But you look into the Sefer HaChinuch, it's a challenge to man. Life is not perfect. You have to make it better. You have to make it more complete. You have to develop yourself physically, materially, spiritually. This is what life is about. Milu ataretz v'kivshuha. And I have to say that there are many challenges, but I never had a finer student who overcame them with more dignity than Mark Dratch. His second wife is also a bit of a student of mine. Her first husband also had been in the Kollel, Rachel, La'aricha Jamim Tovim. And the relationship between Mark and his in-laws and his siblings from his wife's family was admirable. And all of us, Kizera Eva Kadesh, all of us can learn from them. So I want to express my heartfelt condolences, feelings. Your father was very kind to me and very generous. When my work on Rabbi Silver appeared, he spoke here in Jerusalem, spoke so beautifully. When Rakafet Aaron came out, he embraced me and said, wow, you have Sfarim already based upon your publications, your articles. It was really an honor. And later in life, he would come to hear me speak, Mi Anochi, Ma Anochi, and sit there and would come over to me afterwards. I don't want to repeat his words. I'm Ani Modela Kaddish Baruch Hu, that I was privileged to know such a man and to know such a family. And we should all learn and go further. Abishta should give us health, happiness. We should conquer this corona. And we should see more happiness and a lot less sadness and tzar. Hamakom yinachem etchem betoch shaveri tzion v'Yerushalayim. The funeral was already, so you can say it. Let me go further. Let me get a little water. I miss my microphone, but we don't have a choice now. But all right, the year will be over, and I hope no one knows what's going to happen in August. Morty, I'll keep you informed, and you'll inform everyone. I so appreciate it. And we owe Morty a great thanks. Yosef Mordechai, I just want to remind you, you must have that key for me tomorrow. I don't want to have tension. I have a lot in my life that I have to accomplish, and I want to be able to leave grist and dignity and reach my car. The key, even if you have to lie on the floor or bang on the desk like Reb Kamenevich did, the key to be put in my hand tomorrow. It's okay. You don't have to know everything going on, but because of Corona, they have sealed off Chris from Machon Lev, and I have to get back and forth. I just want to mention something I've mentioned about the Malachim. A dear Talmud, the son-in-law of two Talmudim of mine, Leon Frege. It's a brother-in-law to the Yana Rebbe, so keep up covered. Remember we spoke about the Malachim. They sent me a very fascinating article which appeared in Mishpacha. I don't have a date or anything. You just told me Mishpacha. It's evidently online. And this is about his son. And it's fascinating what we spoke about, father's son reaction. Son married a girl from Albany, ran away to Albany. Frum guy, Talmud Chacham, made a living selling insurance, but for many, most years, had no beard, despite his father, who was the malach. You must have a beard, you must dress differently, your portable ghetto, as Rakefet coined the term. And you can see, even Mishpacha, as much as they try to write that he was this, that, the emphasis, he wanted to get away from his father's gestalt. It was too hard for him, but he remained a Frum Jew. It's a very fascinating article about the son. Okay, let us pick up where we left off. I have hundreds of thousands of pages. I don't know if you can see what shows in my office. I hope I can find someone that I can entrust it to who cares about Torah history. Until now, I have struck out, not in dignity. Okay. All right. Last week's lecture was very important. I continue now, and obviously it'll flow over into next week. The conservative rabbinate, you begin with the school 1887, and you're dreaming about a westernized orthodoxy, an enlightened orthodoxy, as Jacob Schiff called it. But somehow, if you don't set the standards, you don't keep the flag up, the mechitza up, you start thinking and broadening and compromising. And ultimately, by the end of World War II, you have rabbis who are sick and tired of Jews having problems. We have to solve everything. And although he was not around at the time and not a member, but I would say the story with Hartman and the Kohanim and women who are divorced, women who are converts, bring them to me, I would be Masada Kedushin. Personal happiness is more important than any halacha. If you take that point of view, then of course, why do we have agunot? Why do people suffer? We should have no problems whatsoever. When we can't do it any other way, we simply cancel, abrogate, negate, abolish the halacha. And yes, life, as we know, has shortcomings, has difficulties. Halavayat would be perfect. But let's be realistic. We're only b'nei t'muta, we're only basar v'dam. And we have to live with difficulties, do the best we can to solve them. But it doesn't mean we have to throw the baby out with the bathwater if the only solution is to forget about this halacha, this rule, this regulation. So the rabbis were clamoring, hafkad kedushin, any woman who has a problem, just say she was never married. Rabbi Finkelstein sensed this. He was caught between two worlds. He himself was observant. He himself understood Torah. He had a faculty that was quite, at that moment in time, I would say, the most elegant faculty involved with Chochmat Yisrael in the world. I don't think the Hebrew youth faculty equaled having Professor Lieberman, Ginsberg, Finkelstein, Marx, and everyone that they had at the seminary. By the end of World War II, Mordechai Kaplan was not the dominant personality he was before. There were now many refugees coming into America, such as Halivni Weiss, who also winds up in the orbit of the seminary. And these people put a bit of a I would say, breaks on Mordechai Kaplan's popularity, a religion without God, a civilization without God, no Matan Torah, God may or may not exist, not important, etc. Finkelstein appealed to Lieberman, and what he said to him in simple language is, leave the ivory tower of teaching. It's time you got involved. If we're not going to get involved with the rabbis in the field, they're going to reform all of Judaism. There'll be nothing left. So they got involved. They fought a battle. They held meetings. And Rabbi Arzt is the first one, Max Arzt. And I described him to you, and he was personally Shomer Shabbos. He was of that ilk, like most conservative rabbis were. They made some compromises, which they felt, give up the mechitza, don't put the women behind the iron bars, don't put them in jail. That way we'll hold on to them, and something will remain of Yiddishkeit. Fine. He made the proposal of the revised ketubah. Professor Finkelstein took it up, and we gave you the English one last week. I can read the first part of the Hebrew. Lamina kol yomei chayeim bi'urcha di'oraita behilchit gavrim yehudiyim. And it means that the couple should live in accordance with Jewish law. If there should be any problem, they go to the Beit Din of the seminary and the RA. And if the Beit Din decides to fine the man, if he won't give a get, the fine will be accepted. Rabbi Lamb, who we just spoke about, and Min HaShemayim, his words of Torah should be a skut. So he analyzes the conservative ketubah at length, and he raises the issue of asmachta, asmachta lo kanya. He raises the issue that it's not a tangible concept going to a Beit Din. How can you make a commitment to do this, Stephen? He raises the issue of they're not going to live in accordance with Jewish law. The whole ketubah is invalid. All right, I don't want to be overwhelmed by the issues he raises. The heart of the issue was, who were these conservative rabbis? They come along, and they're going to change the world, and they're going to change the ketuvah. And Rabbi Lamb alludes to that as well. I'll quote to you, I'm now quoting from the article I introduced you to you last week, the Liebman Clause Revisited, by Benjamin Steiner in the American Jewish Archives. I gave the source last week. And he quotes from the Davar, that Davar, again, you probably heard. Charlie, do you remember Davar? Davar was the daily newspaper of the Labor Party. When we came in Aliyah, I don't know, Morty, in your time, I don't know whether it existed already. But every different party had its Al HaMishma and Davar and Chayrut. Everyone had their own paper, Hatzofer, Sha'arim. I can go on and on. Everyone had their own paper. Now it's basically not even needed because everything is online. But all right, so they had a Haredi Jew write about the Ketubah. And I'm quoting the English translation of what the Haredi wrote. We haven't even looked at the suggested ketubah, because those who permit the marriage of a kohen to a divorcee in contravention to Torah, law, as many conservative rabbis do, are unqualified to innovate in halacha. You follow? So there was this opposition. No one really weighed it halachically. What are they saying? What's so wrong? What's so terrible? They're trying to solve something. You can play games with the ketubah. What is a ketubah? Open up Ebenezer. Remember what I told you. There's so many simonim there that the Aruch HaShulchan didn't even write a commentary on. Because it's not halacha l'maaseh. It's this type of ketubah and that type of ketubah and this minig and that minig. But people were frightened somehow. The conservative rabbinate are based in that this is Yahadut, that they're, what are we talking about? Okay. Within the conservative movement, there was tremendous opposition by the rabbis. Why? Because they considered turning to Professor Lieberman and coming up with an addendum to the Ketuvah fundamentalism, that you are going back to halacha. You are doing nothing to break through. You are trying to solve limited problems of aguna where man will not give a get. What about the other aguna? What about the many women who are in a bad marriage? What about the men who run away? The aguna did not need an orthodox affirmation of the status quo. She needed a conservative resolution with a capital C. The Lieberman clause, the conservative rabbis insisted, was an orthodox solution. Its makers sought through the authority vested in the new Beis Din to move the rabbinical assembly to the right. And this tremendous opposition to Rabbi Lieberman, these are students who barely can open a Gemara from the right side. And here they are. What are you doing to us? We are conservative. Now, no one ever said this better. And here it's quoted time and again. When I'm finished with this part of the conservative Ketuvah, I'll show you I did some research on the man's life as much as I could find. In Philadelphia, there was a Rabbi Edward Tenenbaum. Rabbi Edward Tenenbaum gets up to speak, and now I'm quoting him word by word. This is the rabbinic assembly discussing the Lieberman Ketuvah. For some time now, I had a sneaking suspicion, which was confirmed today, and I certainly hope that you will not think my words harsh. And this suspicion was that the faculty of our seminary was not a conservative faculty in the sense of the conservative movement. I repeat, it's a play on words. Conservative with a small c was not a conservative faculty in the sense of the conservative movement. And what you're going to hear now captures the era. When I left Yeshiva University to come to the seminary, it was precisely because in all good conscience, I felt I could not live according to the laws of the Shulchan Aruch. I had expected, and rightly so, I don't think it was a mistake, that conservative Judaism should be different from Orthodox Judaism. Today we are told that the Shulchan Aruch is to be our guide. And you see, the author of this article says, like so many conservative rabbis, Tenenbaum left Yeshiva College, attended JTS precisely to escape orthodoxy. And now the Lieberman clause threatened to re-anchor him to orthodox texts and institutions of authority. Mark, underline the word authority. You follow? Underline the word authority. That's exactly, this is David Hartman. Halacha pushed away, no authority when it intervenes with personal happiness. Then Tenenbaum goes on, and you see how upset he is with Rabbi Max Ots. Listen to these words. When Rabbi Ots said, remember I quoted it last week, we can't solve all problems. Now watch Rabbi Tenenbaum. I am looking for conservative Judaism. I am not looking for Orthodox Judaism and formation of this particular type of ketubah. It will not strengthen conservative Judaism, but will try to make an Orthodox Jew out of me when I am not an Orthodox Jew. As a moral human being, I say if the halacha does not provide solutions for all instances, then I must insist that we create a new course of action. And until such time as that course of action is created, we have no right to call ourselves a conservative movement, capital C. And wow, these harsh tones. But you hear what he's saying. We're going to play games, halacha, this we can do, this we can't do. No, I want a total breakthrough. There should be no problems at all. And he goes on and on. Tenenbaum continues, today we are told the seminary cannot give us authority. In other words, they were told, who are you? Look at the faculty. This is Professor Shaul Lieberman, world famous Talmud Chacham, Choker par excellence, Bucky and Shasim Poskim. And you're going to open your mouth? Who are you? And the rabbis are told the seminary can only give us a nondescript decree. And if we feel personally qualified, then we can do whatever we want in our particular temple. This is not conservative Judaism. I want to be authorized to act as a rabbi in the conservative movement. Listen to this. I give every one of my waking moments to the Torah and take it away from my family to try to build up Judaism in my community. And my hands are tied because the people who are at the head of this institution are the very people who will say to me, quote, you must live according to orthodoxy and not according to the conservative movement. And you see, this was a good deal of the rabbis. This is already Tenenbaum, product of yeshiva. I don't know. I tried to find out if he went to TA, if he went to Yeshiva College, if he ever graduated. His name is not listed in the volume of the alumni of the yeshiva that came out when Richard Joel became president, which is on to 20 years ago, I would say. It's less than 20 years ago, but it's still at least 15, 16 years. And look what he's saying, you see? He's demanding a total breakthrough, a total solution, a total hafkat kedushin. We are rabbis in the field. We don't want to be spoken down to. We know what's going on. We're not in an ivory tower like Lieberman and Finkelstein and the others. And here you have another rabbi, Rabbi William Greenfield. He already, 1906, 1960, he already was a Talmud of Mordechai Kaplan. He was rabbi in Indianapolis, born in Russia, 1932 JTS graduate, 1946 to the end of his life in Indianapolis. And he gets up to speak. For the first time, to my knowledge, instead of an assembly of rabbis attempting to take a case from civil courts and bring it within their domain, we have almost arbitrarily given up, abdicated our domain, and returned it over, in a sense, to the judgment of the civil courts. It's something with which the majority of our men are concerned. It creates the atmosphere of having found a solution to a problem, but leaves outside its scope many times more problems than it solved. And what you see here is an exact continuation of Tenenbaum's words. This already is someone more to the left of Tenenbaum, Greenfield. What are you solving? Give us Hafgad Kedushin. The halacha shouldn't be binding. Whoever heard rabbis went out of their way to take cases away from the civil courts. With Koshin Mishpat, it's all about having but they didn't. You know what's going on in Israel on this level. And here the Rabbanim are waving their hands and giving the case. We can't solve it. Let the civil court find the man. Back up what the conservative rabbis are doing and let them take care of the solution. And the battle went on and on. The person who mitigated and attempted to bridge the gap was someone very interestingly who I got to meet in Israel. It's Rabbi Ralph Simon of Chicago. Anyone here from Chicago will recognize the name. Rabbi Simon had an apartment on Rehov Herzog. I could see him from my terrace. From my terrace to his terrace, I would look down. I'm on Berlin, but my terrace faces Herzog, faces the Valley of the Cross. And we could wave to each other. And Ralph Simon was I would describe him as a classic JTS graduate, Shoma, Torah, Mitzvah in his own life, compromises in public, but not one willing to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And his point of view, which carried the day, and I have his speech here as well, his point of view was very simple. Listen to what Rabbis Finkelstein and Lieberman are offering us. Grab it. And if we grab it, this will be the first step to more openness and more compromise. In other words, what he was saying was very simple. Find the middle ground. The faculty is orthodox. The rabbis in the field are conservative, and many of them are revolutionary conservative. Kaplan's followers, Reconstructionism, call it what you wish. What has swayed my opinion, and I hope it will sway the opinions of others, is that at the very end of this conference, we got the very first glimpse from a faculty member of willingness to take one step. Don't care how small it is. It is a step. It is a movement into a direction that might indicate where we can go. Rabbi Finkelstein got up, and he was much more adamant. He warned the rabbis, let's not resort to parliamentary tactics. Let's not want a filibuster. Let's not play with a very important Solomon thing. You may think it is a small matter. If you rebuff the faculty once, you will rebuff it forever. They will go back to work and they will live extremely happily. And what happens to those who have rebuffed them, I do not want to say. And here you can imagine this dialogue back and forth, what Professor Finkelstein is telling the rabbis. You rebuff the faculty, they'll go back to their scholarship. They'll be the happiest people in the world to close the door. As I told you, Rabbi Schreiber working on the Meiri, Rabbi Lieberman working on the Tosefta Kapshuta, the other faculty members working in their fields, and each one had a specialty. There was Professor Higa, the Masechtat Ketanot, etc. I can give more examples, not necessary. And they'll have nothing to do and look upon you guys as reform rabbis. I'm warning you, don't break the umbilical cord. And finally, despite all the skepticism and all the criticism, the rabbinical assembly went ahead and accepted the Lieberman Ketuvah. The Lieberman Ketuvah became the norm. Okay. We're setting the stage. So, that's the story with the Ketuvah. That's the story of how it finally was passed, adopted, and taken on as a shofar call, a defining symbol, a defining flag raised by the conservative movement. Before we go further, I just want to mention some biographical material so you get a feel of who these people were. Before all this happened, you have to understand something. This becomes very important in the next stage, the attempt to form a joint based in. The conservative movement always had part of the seminary, a special based in, I'll call it, that handled Gittin. The person who handled the Gittin was Professor Boaz Cohn. Make believe you know who I'm talking about, so the ignorant pass for the wise. Boaz Cohn was an unbelievable individual, American born, years 1899, 1968. A real Talmud Chacham. Trained at the seminary. Studied for a doctorate at Columbia U, did a doctorate on the comparison of halacha and the Roman legal system. But he was a lot more than that. He was an expert of responsa literature. And his Quintus Hatshuvot, which was published back in 1930, was basic to anyone who wanted to study responsa literature. Today, his Quintus Hatshuvot has given birth to many other works, and we have in the Gris Library the latest work that was put out by Bar Ilan and JTS jointly. It's now four tremendous volumes following the same format of Boaz Cohn telling you who the Meshivim were, where they lived, what they published, what was unique about them. He had encyclopedic knowledge. He wrote, he published bibliographies of people from the seminary, Professor Israel Friedlander, you may recall he translated the Meron Avuchim, Louis Ginsberg, Alexander Marx, was a fabulous individual. His Gittin were accepted by everyone, including the Agudas HaRabbanim, including the Litvish Rabbanim in America at that time. Everyone accepted Boaz Cohen as totally reliable. So here you have one player in the field, and in World War II, no one would question his Gittin. However, you have to remember, he could only administer a get if you came to him and requested a get. It's not that the rabbis out in the field all were sending people to him for gittin, but when a get was needed and a conservative rabbi felt it should be done properly, they either sent the people to Anagudas HaRabbanim, to a Beis Din, to a reliable in every city. There were big cities. There were Elder Rabbanim and Europeisha Rabbanim who handled Gittin, or they sent them to Boaz Cohen. I have to tell you, over the years, I have met direct descendants of Boaz Cohen, total Shomrei Torah U'Mitzvah. Rabbi Edward Tenenbaum already, very interesting individual. 1918 to 2010. He was a congregational rabbi for 70 years. He was executive director of the Southwest region of the United Synagogue of America, chairman of the conversion based in of the Rabbinical Assembly, the West States religion. Winds up, I can tell you the exact year, 1965, he comes to Temple Beth Zion in Los Angeles. Now, Temple Beth Zion, anyone know what I mean by the Miracle Mile in Los Angeles? There was this area, Olympic Boulevard. By the way, those who are familiar with Los Angeles should know that Los Angeles creates tremendous problems for building an Erev in a public Reshut HaRabim. Why? You're wondering, why should Los Angeles be any different than any other big city? If you look at a map, Olympic Boulevard, Wilshire Boulevard, they're adjacent to each other. One to the left, one to the right. These boulevards go all the way through LA, from all the way downtown, all the way to the Pacific Ocean. So it could very well be that they have a status of Stratul Klatja, a perfect highway that doesn't curve left, doesn't curve east. So it's interesting, it's an interesting question. Let's leave that question alone and come back to the Miracle Mile. Olympic Boulevard, at one time, it was beyond downtown. It's near where all the oil fields were at the turn of two centuries ago. Their pits there, tar pits there. They found dinosaur bones there. It's a whole history of Los Angeles. At one time, people lived there. People made a living, and they put up a, I don't know if the shoe began Orthodox, but it became a very prominent conservative temple, Temple Beth Zion. As the years moved on, the area remained desolate. They weren't digging for oil then. They didn't have the oil, dribs is the word. You can correct me if I'm wrong. The area changed, run down. And the shoes, the whole area, went under. Along came a builder, a developer, and he came up with the idea, and this goes back to the late 20s, early 30s. I think it's before the crash, it probably was late 20s. He's going to redevelop this area. He's going to turn it around. And he started building housing and streets, and Olympic Boulevard, became the home of the big department stores. It became the posh, beautiful area, big art museum, the Los Angeles Art Museum, other museums. Oh, what went on there? And they said, what this man did. Anyone who invested, your dollar became worth $1,000 within a few years. It was called the Miracle Mile. But you see, what happened is what's happening all over. You come up in time, post-World War II, suburbia is developed. Suburbia developed, the shopping centers developed. And all around LA, you had major, major shopping centers. Olympic Boulevard already lost its attraction, lost its pull. And by the time he became rabbi, the shoe was starting to go down. But here with the conservative movement, it's fascinating, and you see this all over. because their Shabbos is not a Teredik Shabbos, they can drive Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. So there's certain times during the year where the temples fill up again. All the children and grandchildren will have residue feeling. It's like a Hasidic Yid who remembers the shtibbel where he ate cholent on Shabbos, who remembers what it was to be at the Rebbe's Tish. All these people can drive in. So Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, the temple can be filled. On Shabbos, they don't even have a minion. And you see this time and again. Anyone here from the five towns, you look at Temple Israel, right in the heart of the five towns, two blocks away from Shaarei Tefillah, three blocks away, four blocks away from the White Shul. Tremendous structure, Gothic building, empty all year. Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, the parking lot is filled. People are driving in from all over the island. My grandfather prayed here. I go to shul twice a year. I go where my grandfather went. This is what became of Temple Beit Zion. And I'm quoting from an article that was written, let me see if I get a date here, 1997. At first glance, Temple Beit Zion on a busy stretch of Olympic Boulevard in the mid-city looks stark and abandoned. The front door is locked. The religious school has been closed for almost four decades. The daily minyan and Friday night services have gone. Many of the some 135 members, most of whom are age 75 to 80, can no longer drive at night. In the last 6 months alone, the acting rabbi and the rabbi's wife died. One board member suffered a stroke. Another had a leg amputation. Another sustained a fall and is temporarily in a convalescent home. And the executive vice president had open heart surgery. Not a very happy description. But nevertheless, there's the rabbi. They interview him. And he talks about all of the years he's been here and the problems, but we got to keep going. And we have a big crowd, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Purim, Hanukkah, people who remember the temple. And he talks about the two new co-presidents, its sisters, Lynn Strutt Weintraub and Judy Strutt Hollander, and their father had been president of the shul, and we've got to keep the shul going. Temple Beit Zion, after the rabbi died, I checked out what's going on today. They never hired a rabbi again, but a woman leads the congregation. There she is, if you see her, with the talit. That is Cantor. Let me get her name, Gorer Lelik, I believe it is. 1 second, I'll show you her name. Cantor Gorer Guralnik. Cantor Guralnik. Here's her picture again. And she will lead, they tell you the services, but above all, they tell you Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, give you the dates, and tell you, make the reservations. Here's the president, and the days that she doesn't lead the service, President Hollander leads the service. There she is with the president. This is the shul. This is what became of it. They keep it going. It's still around today. No rabbi after Rabbi Tenenbaum. On 2010, a righteous person passed away while preparing for Sabbath services. During his career, he was a congregational rabbi, 70 years, rabbi of Temple Zion from 1965 to 2010, and they go on to list the other places where he officiated, what he did. So you get a feeling this was Rabbi Tenenbaum. This is conservative Judaism. Can it survive? What did they do? This was what happened in Queens. The big three major conservative congregations combined. Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, the parking lot is still beyond capacity. During the year, half and half, people drive from all over. The rabbi is a woman, the cantor is a woman, the executive director is a woman, and an Icho Sheish, they'll one day be assigned there. Men are not allowed into the sanctuary. You are not on the level of someone who bears the feminine mystique. And they may be right, who knows? Let me end off Ralph Simon. Ralph Simon already, middle of the road, 1906, 1996, born in Newark, New Jersey, and a City College graduate of the seminary, 1931, rabbi in Queens, and then he becomes, 1937, the rabbi of Congregation Rodeg Tzedek in Hyde Park. And Rodeg Tzedek, that was the conservative temple. He instituted under his tutelage a Talmud Torah that became one of the most famous conservative Talmud Torahs in the United States. People would study, in other words, other Talmud Torahs, their curriculum, their class structure, how they dealt with teachers, how often they met, from Talmud Torah, organized the Dope Education that was very successful, was president of the Chicago Board of Rabbis, and one of them, I would say, perhaps the most famous rabbinic figure in all of Chicago during the time of his prime years, and the rabbinate and the synagogue in Hyde Park. But more than that, he helped organize Ramah Camp in the Midwest. And here it describes what type of camp that was: Hebrew speaking, religiously oriented, operating under the auspices of the conservative movement. You all know that Camp Ramah produced many Jews who later went on to become 100% religious Jews, Talmidei Chachamim among them. It had a real, real traditional background. It's not that everyone who went there became frum, but those who already started asking questions and started learning, me'emet ha'koronet ha'shma, as the Rav used to say, why do we have the fear kushis? Why do we have the abba kashiot? Why? We want to teach a Jew to ask questions. And when a Jew asks questions, we know where it begins. We don't know where it's going to end. And he, Ramah, Board of Rabbis, very active, but active in another sense, the state of Israel. He was responsible, the Shechters, when they opened the branch here, when Rehov Agron, he had a role in all that happened in the state of Israel. He was very pro-Israel. I don't know where his children are, grandchildren, but I wouldn't be surprised to hear that part of his descendants live in the state of Israel. He was one when they coined the term here, you know, they had a problem that they couldn't use the word conservative Judaism because it people could critique it right away, you're changing, so they used the word Mesorati, Yahadut Mesoratit, I believe that's the word they use until today, so that they can sort of position themselves between Torah and Mesorah and the innovativeness of the conservative movement. But this was Ralph Simon, but very different individual than Rabbi Isaac Tenenbaum. Rabbi Isaac Tenenbaum, you can see, filled with the feeling, the spirit, we have to break through, we have to change, we have to open the floodgate. Nothing should stand in our way. Rabbi Ralph Simon was more of a compromise, a trying to blend between the old and the new, trying to make the rabbis in the field, the ones who followed Mordechai Kaplan, and even those more to the right of Mordechai Kaplan, if the seminary faculty is willing to take the first step, I'll put in, what's the Chinese proverb? A tiul, a hike, a passage, a a travelogue of 1,000 miles begins with but a first step. Don't be opposed. Take the first step. We'll see what happens 10 years from now. On the other hand, you have Rabbi Finkelstein, who's telling the rabbis, don't spit in the face of the faculty. They're going to be very happy closing their doors, not being involved with you, and going back to their scholarship. Then you have people like Boaz Cohen, who were loved, respected by all segments of the Torah world. They knew the man was a Talmud Chacham. All right, he grew up in the seminary. He went to the seminary when it was basically an Orthodox institution. He grew up there, he remained there, he stayed there, his life was there. I can understand it. But his gittin were accepted by all. My dear students, we've now set the stage for one of the most fascinating moments in American Torah history. And we really have no documents whatsoever. What comes next was kept under lock and key for obvious reasons. The proposal is mind-boggling. What could have been. On the other hand, it could be, you know, a guy is a dream. He's a teenage kid of 19. He's going to marry a girl who's got it all. I don't know, whatever you're looking for. Brains. I have some students who say to me, and one student would always say, he was married twice. He said, I only look for brains. Looks are not important. Okay, there's brains. She has looks. Sheker Ahem, the Hevel Hayofi. I'll give you a Kefet spot. Who can say Sheker Ahem when you have it? Oh, she has Chain and she has Yofi. Then she undeserves. Then you're at Hashem. But if there's no Sheker Ahem, the Hevel Hayofi, it's not there to begin with. Well, so only you're at Shemeni, many God. This girl has everything. 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 What if, and yeah, he's dreaming. And then there's reality. When a guy hits 25, 30 today, I don't know. You gotta make your compromises. Ribbono Shelolam. The dream was overwhelming. The joint baked in. In reality, it couldn't get off the floor. But I'll put together the story. I would say 90% of what I have to say I'm absolutely right. Could be the other 10%, it's theory. Maybe one day they can somehow do better research, but I don't think it's possible. And we'll understand what happened. So to reiterate, what did we do today? Baruch Hashem, first of all, we said a few words about Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. It's the end of an era, but life lives on. We have to go further in dignity. Secondly, we finished out the conservative club, but we haven't really finished it because I have to show you how it leads to the RCA club, which is obvious, but we can't get to the RCA club without dealing with the joint basin. And the joint basin is a fascinating chapter. Wow. The Rav and Professor Lieberman waltzing together. Could you imagine? All right. And then when we're finished that, well, I'm sure to say a few words about the RCA Ketuvah and you'll see how it morphs from the conservative Ketuvah and all that happened afterwards. Be'ezrat Hashem, next Sunday, we meet at our normal time, Morty, 9:30, and we pick up just where we left off, the Shacht Saniyot, showing off her jewelry to her friends, the Aruch HaShulchan, and take it further from there. I would like a few women to comment on the Aruch HaShulchan, and I laugh when I go back to my comment. We're going to translate the Aruch HaShulchan into English. Not exactly a text that you can put around and for the followers of Chovevei Torah. But all right, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that they can accept a certain reality. Are there any questions, Mori? Well, let me just say, until we meet again, in health and happiness, das vidanya. Mori, throw it open if anyone has.
Okay, let me.